The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The FT. Welcome to this edition of World Weekly with me, Gideon Rachman. This week we look at the strange trial of a dead man, Sergei Magnitsky. What does it tell us about Putin's Russia? With me on the line from Moscow is our bureau chief there, Charles Clover. From Washington we've got Jeff Dyer, our diplomatic correspondent. And in the studio, Neil Buckley, a former Moscow bureau chief who's now our East Europe editor. Neil, can you just fill us in on the background? Who was Magnitsky and why is he now being subjected to this posthumous trial?
Well, Sergei Magnitsky was a corporate lawyer. He was employed by an investment fund called Hermitage Capital, which was, in fact, one of the biggest foreign investors in Russia. The head of Hermitage Capital, a guy called Bill Browder, was excluded from Russia for reasons that have never been fully explained a number of years ago. And then the shell of that investment fund, essentially, was used as a vehicle by officials in the tax authorities to perpetrate a scam whereby they awarded a tax rebate, which these officials then collected to the tune of $230 million. Magnitsky was employed to look into this, and in the process, he found himself arrested by the people he was actually looking into and charged himself with wrongdoing. And then he died in a Moscow jail, apparently beaten to death in a very tragic case in 2009. The reason he's now on trial posthumously, absurd as it sounds, is that the Russian authorities appear to be trying to blacken his name to say, well, this is someone who himself had a criminal conviction. He's on trial for alleged tax evasion in response to measures that have been put in place in the US and elsewhere against those who were involved in the Magnitsky case.
So you mentioned those measures, Jeff, in Washington. I mean, the Magnitsky case has become a cause célèbre in America and they've passed the Magnitsky law. Can you explain why it's had such purchase and what the Magnitsky law is aimed at doing?
Well, the Magnitsky law aims at trying to punish the officials who are behind the torture and death of Magnitsky. So it blocks any assets those officials have in the U.S. and bans them from traveling to the U.S. But the people behind the law hope to make it a sort of test case for a broader approach to these kinds of human rights violations, and hope that maybe if this has some sort of leverage with the Russians, they might be able to broaden it to include other human rights violators in other countries. The reason why the law came into place, I mean, there is a lot of disdain for Russia. There was a lot of in Congress especially, the story of Magnitsky had a big impact here. It garnered a lot of support. But still, the bill didn't really get anywhere for a while. But then last year, Russia came up for entry into the WTO, and the supporters of the bill had an ingenious legislative trick where essentially they said to the administration, we will only pass the bill you need to get passed in order to approve Russia's entry in the WTO if you also let the Magnitsky bill pass. And then that's why it went through.
Charles, how much damage has the Magnitsky law done to people in power, the Russian elite?
I mean, they do seem to be very nervous about this. I'm not sure it's so much the law is passed in the U.S., but the prospect that Schengen countries, that the European Union could pass similar laws, and that would give a mechanism to shut, you know, pretty much the entire West to, you know, a portion of the Russian elite, and this would set a huge precedent.
How many people would be affected?
Well, at the moment, it's about 60 people who are on the Magnitsky list. The thing that I think spooks the Kremlin is that this law is so open-ended and it's so easy to add new names to the list. It's basically people who are suspected of human rights violations, which could be in relation to the Magnitsky case or pretty much anywhere in Chechnya, or people who are suspected of falsifying election results or things like that. So it's quite an open-ended law, and it could conceivably spiral into something that's actually quite significant in terms of the Russian elite.
Charles, how have the Russians now come to the conclusion that putting a dead man on trial, putting Magnitsky on trial, will help?
It's a fairly tone-deaf response, to be honest. One gets the impression that whoever thought of doing this wasn't really aware of how it would play internationally and even domestically, that this sort of pushes the boundaries of the absurd and just shows exactly how desperate these people are to push back against this possibility of more legislation being passed in Europe. I mean, I think that's pretty much why they're doing this now. That said, it's not terribly surprising. I don't think this was thought of by great minds in the Kremlin. I've always had the impression that this was a sort of a gang of rogue law enforcement officials who all look out for each other and who have prevented any sort of accountability in this matter. And for whatever reason, the Kremlin has either chosen not to or is unable to intervene. And they've decided to push this posthumous trial in order to make, in their eyes, it strengthens their own case, the thing to the West. You can't pass this legislation because this man is a convicted criminal.
How quickly do you think this trial will go ahead? Will it even definitely go ahead? And can we assume that Magnitsky will be convicted in absentia, so to speak?
I think we can assume that he'll be convicted. His relatives have already made it clear that they don't intend to fight this. They're not even going to show up for the trial. They think that it sort of damages them to even be associated with this, and I think it's utterly ridiculous. That said, it's entirely possible that cooler heads could prevail and smarter people in the Kremlin could decide, well, this is actually really, really stupid, and we need to make sure that we need to stop this. I mean, what's happened so far is that they've had a preliminary hearing on Monday. The judge has named a new court date about a month from now. It's possible that there's some attempt to just sort of kick this into the long grass, and this may actually never go ahead. But at the moment, it seems like everybody's very serious about putting this guy on trial.
Now, Neil, I mean, obviously, beyond the immediate impact of this trial, it raises questions about the nature of Russia now. President Putin's been back in the Kremlin since May. What do you think we can infer from the trial, and does it fit a larger pattern of behaviour from the kind of Putin too?
Yes, I think it does fit into a broader pattern of behaviour to a certain extent, which is very much a pushback against any kind of foreign influence or perceived attempts by the West to exert any kind of influence or meddle in Russian affairs. There's been a narrative from Vladimir Putin ever since the protests broke out after the parliamentary elections at the end of 2011 that these were somehow orchestrated by the West. And the Magnitsky case, the lobbying that's being done by the West over this is seen as another form of interference in our own affairs. And what you've seen since Putin came back to the presidency is a kind of an upsurge of conservatism and a soft nationalism, which seems to be really aimed at his base support, his core supporters outside Moscow and the big cities, who tend to be more conservative and more sceptical or suspicious of the outside world, perhaps reflecting that Putin has really lost a lot of support among the wealthier and better educated, better travelled middle class in the cities.
Jeff, it sounds like this could be part of an emerging crisis in U.S.-Russian relations. Of course, the Americans passed the Magnitsky Law, but did they anticipate quite what damage it could be doing to what, after all, was a relationship that Obama had set out to work on and to improve?
Absolutely. I mean, the reaction is, I think it's playing into the very worst impressions that a lot of people in Washington already had about Putin, about the sense that it's becoming a much more authoritarian country, much more anti-American, anti-Western. If you remember during the election campaign, Mitt Romney described Russia as our number one geopolitical foe, and a lot of people scoffed at him at the time. But that is a sentiment that it's becoming quite kind of widely shared, particularly in Congress. And so that does set it up for, as you say, for this to escalate into a much bigger crisis. But if you're thinking about it from terms of the administration, which was always against the bill in the first place, if you think about all the things that Barack Obama wants to do abroad in his second term, the strange thing is a lot of them do involve some sort of help or support from Russia. He's thinking about Iran. The best way for him to avoid a war in Iran is to keep pretty tight international sanctions. For that, he needs some sort of Russian support. He's desperately trying to avoid getting involved in Syria. The best hope he has for that is to try and get the Russians to gradually switch sides in Syria. He said he wants to reduce the U.S. nuclear stockpile in the course of his second term. That would make much more sense politically, much easier politically, if somehow he can get Russia on board on that. He wants to get out of Afghanistan, which he's going to need some sort of Russian assistance to physically get troops and equipment out of Afghanistan. And even the defense cuts that are now going to be planned over the next few years, one of the obvious places for a lot of that to happen is the U.S. forces in Europe. That'll be much more politically easier if Russia isn't scaring the living daylights out of everyone in Central and Eastern Europe. Then you go through the administration's second-term agenda, there are lots of areas where he needs, at the very least, to have a viable working relationship, if not actual Russian support, to get things done.
Charles, perhaps I can finish with you. How does all this feel in Moscow? You said that they feel a bit under siege. Neil talked about the kind of slightly paranoid style of Putin too. And I guess the economics could be moving against them with America developing its own form of gas supplies. Is there an anxiety behind the kind of way that Russia's behaving? Or is it more a kind of truculent feeling that they're going to show the world?
I think it's certainly more anxiety-driven. I mean, yes, certainly on the economic front, there's a lot of uncertainty about the price of oil, which has been sustaining Russian growth. On the political front, I think that everybody in Moscow sees that the West is not entirely happy with Putin's third term. And I think the Kremlin is, determined to show the world that, Russia is a sovereign nation and don't mess around with our internal politics. And if you do, we have instruments that we can bring to bear. But I think also all politics is local, and you have to look at the domestic political situation in Russia just to really understand where things are coming from. I mean, as Neil was talking about with the middle-class opposition movement, the liberal levers that were formerly used to temper a sort of knee-jerk patriotic nationalism in the Kremlin have been abandoned. And those people who used to influence the Kremlin, I think a lot of them are now discounted as being, in the opposition or sort of seen as almost treasonous. And Putin is counting on a new constituency, a sort of less educated, more provincial, and more conservative, and a much more xenophobic constituency. And so a lot of what we're seeing from the Kremlin is actually just sort of populist electioneering, keeping the daily majority going, keeping the base happy, kind of thing. And to back off this nationalism, to back off this sort of xenophobic policies would be seen as a sign of weakness, and that's something that Putin absolutely cannot demonstrate right now for political reasons.
Charles Clover in Moscow, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Jeff Dyer in Washington, to Neil Buckley here in the studio in London, to Martin Starber behind the controls in the studio. That's it for this week. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.